is Hyperspace Theology, exploring what we can know about life and faith and God Almighty through a galaxy far, far away.
Man, Tales of the Jedi look good.
I got to see the first episode of it at Celebration in a big convention hall with 4,000 people, big screen.
Is it as good as the trailer makes it look?
I'll wait until you see it.
That's no.
It was good. It was good. I didn't necessarily personally connect with the first episode, but that doesn't mean that it isn't good. I mean, it was a well-told story. It looked good. It had, you know, it's like Ahsoka's origin story, like baby Ahsoka. This was about her mom and baby Ahsoka. I was personally hoping for an adaptation of the 90s comic series, Tales of the Jedi. They've straight up hijacked the exact logo from that series. And those are some of my favorite, very favorite Star Wars stories of all time.
Well, that's what Star Wars likes to do.
So I went in with unreasonable expectations that then were not met. And Filoni was like, yeah, we're going to do it my way. And I was a little bit disappointed. But it doesn't mean that the actual product is bad.
It's a pretty good Filoni impression.
It's a little offensive. I appreciate it.
My opinion on both the Star Wars and Marvel shows are, you got to temper your expectations for the medium. You know, a television show is not going to be a movie, and you know, you got to be okay. You have to lower your expectations and like, okay, no, that's a fine show.
Welcome to Hyperspace Theology, a show in which we are exploring theology through the lens of a galaxy far, far away, from belief to redemption, orthodoxy to resurrection. The Star Wars galaxy is jam-packed with theological themes, and we're going to crack them wide open. Hopefully, this can be of help to you in your journey of faith, or at the very least, can enhance your appreciation for the galaxy we all know and love. We are united by our love for lightsabers, spaceships, and Jesus Christ, our Lord. I'm your host, Jared Mays. Joining me once again this week is Dr. Kevin Burr. Kevin, are you excited for Andor?
I'm tempering my expectations. I hope it will be good. I'm interested to see how they deal with some pretty complex issues, because I think that when you talk about rebelling against established authority, you get into some pretty complex issues. So I'm interested.
You could say that. It's kind of like the backbone of our nation. So. Yeah, hopefully Americans appreciate it.
We'll see how they go with it. But yes, generally I liked Andor's character in Rogue One, and so I'm looking forward to seeing more of him.
Also joined by our other friend from the Great White North, and by that I mean it's not quite white yet, but it will be before you know it. Scott Howland, how are you?
Don't remind me it's about snow. I'm not exactly the biggest fan of snow, but I'm doing pretty good after some health issues. I'm doing pretty good. I feel like I derailed the show a little bit with my health issues, but I'm back.
The honest truth is also, nothing derails the show more than my own sense of inertia. So I'm glad to have your health is an excuse, but that's not the real reason.
But Jared, in your own case of laryngitis too.
That's right. I had to go an entire week as a preacher and a podcaster. This is just sheer torture. I had to go an entire week without saying a word. I was literally
knowing you personally, I could just see you just probably turning red and shaking and like, wanting to speak. And
I was literally, there was one day where I carried around a whiteboard at work and I would write down what I had to say. And it eventually got so maddening because I couldn't keep up as fast as everybody else could talk. And I would just like stick a finger out and point. And it was like, wait a second. And then they would like misread a word or something. And I had to shake my head. And I was, you know, doing the no good, you know, signal with my arms. Like you just missed a field goal. It's like you misread the word. And somebody misread the word Corinthians as Chronicles. And it was a mess.
Tragic.
I'm not going to write any of this tonight on a whiteboard. We're not going to mistake Corinthians for Chronicles. We would never do such a thing. We are
Corinthians for Calrissian.
Hey, that's pretty good.
There we go.
I love that. Scott, I asked Kevin about Andor. Before the show, you were saying you're also tempering your expectations. You're trying to go in with a sense of reasonableness. First of all, what's that like?
It's unusual for a Star Wars fan, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I do not have that ability.
I've always gone at these things with the utmost, confidence, but the utmost excitement. And then sometimes I'll see it and I'll be like, okay, yeah. And then it just starts to, as I think about it, it wanes a little bit. I've tried to be a little more pragmatic about some of these things. But Rogue One is probably my favorite Disney era Star Wars movie.
It's hard to disagree with that take.
I think it is so good. And going back to that part of the world and with some characters that we know and hopefully some new ones. I can't wait for a snarky K2SO.
Is he confirmed in it? Do we know for sure?
I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah.
It's a missed opportunity if he's not.
It could be like a season two thing, right? I mean, we all want him and are craving him. It could be like the very end, the season finale. What are the chances that K2SO is in this? High. They're very high. See what I did there? Well, the one character that I want the most, and I'm having a hard time managing my expectations. My expectations for the show, not really all that high. I just haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it. I haven't watched all the trailers. I've tried to just wait. And then when it comes out, I'll watch it and I'm sure I'm going to dig it. But I've kind of taken
the same tack myself. Yeah. Is okay. I've saw one trailer. All right. I'm good now. I'm not watching any of the discourse online about That's it. Right. I'm not watching any of that stuff.
Don't let anybody ruin it for you. The one character, however, that I've not managed my expectations surrounding is Bail Organa. I want to see Bail in this more than I can possibly say. Jimmy Smits as Bail Organa is my favorite thing in all of Star Wars. And he's like Mon Mothma's right-hand man in, you know, starting the rebellion. You got the Imperial Senate. And he's Leia's dad. I mean, I love him. He's Yoda and Obi-Wan's BFF. And I also want to be his BFF. And yet all I can do is sit over here and just cross my fingers and hope that he shows up on my TV. I'll say this much, listeners, if he does, just like go ahead and pause your TV and listen. No matter where you are in the world, I guarantee you will hear me screaming. You're out walking your dog, you're doing dishes, wherever. I guess you actually have to be like parked in front of a screen of some sort. That's right. I will be screaming somewhere if Bail Organa is in this show. He is absolutely.
I sense a disturbance in the force.
Yeah, you will sense it. You'll sense it. I've actually got plans with a buddy here. I need to get him turned on to the show. He's a Christian and a Star Wars fan. He has like a big home theater with these big leather like theater seats, the recliners and projector screens. So we are going to do. The trouble is it's on like a Wednesday night, isn't it? That's tough for.
But it's like midnight. Ministry. Is it?
I thought it was Thursdays. I thought Disney switched to their releases on Thursdays.
It sounds to me like I need to do some Googling.
Yeah, they moved all their Marvel shows to Thursdays. So okay. I was under the assumption that Thursdays was going to be their day now.
Whatever the day is that it comes out, he and I are supposed to watch these things in his home theater. And he had better not go back on that promise because I'm pretty much expecting it. But let us know, everybody, what you think about Andor. If you have any episode ideas specifically surrounding or related to or even tangentially somehow a little bit not really connected to Andor, please shoot those episode ideas at us. Kevin, where's the best place for people to do that?
We have a variety of social media outlets through which we can be contacted. We have an email address that Jared is going to tell us what the email address is.
Yeah, it's hyperspacetheology@gmail.com. I totally even checked it tonight, for real. And so... Yeah. It does work.
And we also have a new private Facebook group. It's private because we want there to be some degree of gatekeeping to ensure that the content stays on task, that everyone understands the assignment. So, you know, what we're doing in that Facebook group is not commenting on, well, you know, this person was poorly cast, or, you know, they wrote this character really unlikably, or whatever. What we're hoping to do with that Facebook group is essentially generate conversation that in that group that is like what we're doing here on the podcast. And I think we'll get into that here in just a moment, where an idea from that group is what we're using as our springboard tonight. So that Facebook group is there. If you're interested, if any listener is interested in getting and finding that group, send one of us a message or something, or email the Gmail account, and we'll be happy to get you a Facebook invite to that group.
Yeah. Also, no droids allowed. Like Wooher the bartender, we don't serve their kind here. No bots. Just humans, real people, want to make a real connection, talking about this made up galaxy.
And the group is called Hyperspace Theology. You should be able to search it on there. And you have to answer a simple question, and which if you can't answer, then I don't know what you're doing. About who your favorite Star Wars character is.
I don't even know what the question is now. Kind of like,
who's your favorite Star Wars character?
Okay. And if anybody doesn't answer Bail Organa, you're not allowed in the group, right? I don't know that we had.
I think Scott changed that. He had that up there when you were there.
since I'm the guy who seems to be approving all these people, that's not a requirement.
It's a single choice question.
It can be Bail Organa. That's fine. But
it's acceptable.
You could go with Jared's second favorite, Salacious Crumb.
Oh, I do love Salacious Crumb. Oh, hey, in one of the trailers, did y'all see this?
Yes.
One of the trailers, there's a tree full of Kwaki and monkey lizards looking like they're up to no good.
That's in a new Mando trailer.
Oh,
season three Mando trailer.
That's what it is. Yep.
Which I am absurdly excited for. I know I've said I've tempered my expectations for everything. I am absurdly excited for this show.
Even with tempered expectations.
Yes.
Scott's level is absurdly excited.
Mandalorian armor. Beskar steel forged in the forges of woman.
Doom.
What's it?
Sorry, yeah. Mixing mythologies.
The armor.
Yeah. What's the forge? What's the planet? The one with Navarro? Anyway. Yeah, I'm very excited for that. I saved that Kowakian and monkey lizard image as a background on my computer. And that's how much I love these. Oh, I totally forgot about that. Now my heart is racing. I'm a little bit sweaty.
So any answer in between Salacious Crumb and Bail Organa would be accepted.
Yes. And tonight's topic comes from Blast from the Past, a buddy of mine, who is partly responsible, or to blame, depending on how we want to slice it, for some of my Star Wars fandom. That is, Donovan Fox was a youth minister at a local church where I grew up. He was not my youth minister, which is good because I probably never would have stopped talking to him about Star Wars and let him actually teach the Bible. He loaned me a copy of Darth Bane, Path of Destruction. I took it to the beach on vacation. And now I have a Star Wars Expanded Universe podcast that we have 105 episodes of. And so it's all Donovan's fault, right? At least partially. Anyway, Donovan, wonderful person. He has given us this topic, gave us a handful. The one that we're going to tackle tonight is, what do you make of Obi-Wan's from a certain point of view? You know what he's talking about, right, Scott?
When he's talking to Luke about when he first told him that Darth Vader killed his father, and then he's like, well, you know, he became Darth Vader. So in a certain point of view, Vader did kill Anakin. And they've kind of retconned it a bit, especially in the Obi-Wan show, where you can see it's two distinct personalities between Vader and Obi-Wan. So they've kind of retconned it a bit.
There's a lot of retconning involved.
Yes, that they should rename it from Star Wars to Retconville. But
I'd still watch it. They're on
Dagobah when he's talking about his father being Darth Vader and stuff, and saying, well, this is how I, so it's kind of like how I interpret the thing, even though I wrote, you know, Lucas really wrote it a different way and had to fix it later.
Yeah. So, the original line in Star Wars and A New Hope was, Darth Vader betrayed and murdered your father, right? Later on, we find out, no, I am your father. No! And then finally, we're mopping up the mess, Return of the Jedi. He says, was Darth Vader really my, is he really my father? And dying Yoda gives him the side eye and says, your father he is. He dies. Obi-Wan's Force ghost shows up, the blue glowy, has to finally explain himself. Luke asks, you know, hey, what's going on here? You told me that Darth Vader betrayed and murdered my father. And he says, well, it all depends on your point of view, right? And he says, yeah, you'll learn that a great many things in life depend greatly on your point of view, right? Isn't there like a follow-up line there?
Something like that, yeah.
A great number of things depend drastically on our on our point of view, which is a real rabbit hole, isn't it?
It's also a pretty, in some ways, it's very accurate, where people take different views on everything. And you can see, some people can see the same image and see two different things. So that's kind of, I think, where, you know, they were going with that. So, and I think that really applies a lot of times in our own world, in our own.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a Christian's perspective on truth, and also Star Wars' own approach to how truth is revealed and held from one person to another. First and foremost, let's talk about that behind the scenes drama of it all. What do you make of Star Wars' tremendous revisionist history? I mean, there are so many layers upon layers upon layers of getting back to the original intent and the story as it was first developed by Lucas. Then he goes back and in interviews, he says, well, I always meant it this way. Whereas we know for a fact on some of these things, he didn't. Kevin, how do you keep this all straight? How do you stay a Star Wars fan when Lucas is always changing his tune and the sequels weren't all mapped out from the beginning in the first place? And what do we do with all of this? The ever shifting tectonic plates of the truth of what even is the story of Star Wars?
Man, that is that's a big question.
You got 60 seconds, go.
And yeah. Solve pi for 67 places too.
3.1415 29. That's all I got.
I was tapped out after the four.
It is humbling for me to think about what it is that Lucas has put together, because were I to be in his shoes, I'm confident that I could maybe put together a compelling story, but not nearly a story as grand and epic and mythological and moving and emotional and spectacular and fantastic as what he has done.
Yeah.
And I do some preaching from time to time and do a lot more teaching, but I do enough preaching and enough teaching. And Jared, you might be able to speak to this as well, that sometimes when you start out like a sermon or, you know, some kind of speech that involves some degree of performance. Now, performance there doesn't mean disingenuous, but it's still an act of speaking in a yeah. way to be persuasive. Sometimes you start out in a going one direction, and then you realize that what you had wanted to tell might have either missed the mark or wasn't big enough or deep enough or substantive enough, and you begin to kind of shift gears, and then you have to go back. And that happens with storytelling. And, you know, when you throw in the fact that there's decades, literal decades in between, you know, this set of stories and that set of stories and all of that, I'm willing to cut him some slack for, you know, for some of these strange things that show up from time to time.
I draw pretty much a direct parallel between Obi-Wan's propensity for fudging the truth with Lucas's own propensity for doing so.
Like Obi-Wan is Lucas's mouthpiece.
Now I'm kind of like wanting to do an entire episode, maybe for my other podcast, I'm not sure the best place for it, on all the times Lucas has changed his tune regarding what is the story of Star Wars. You know, he's gone on record saying there were originally 12 films mapped out, or there were only three, or it was always meant to be six. You know, he just changes the story. Or, yeah, I always intended for Vader to be Luke's father, whereas we have some other quotes where he says, no, I figured that out in the writing of the draft for The Empire Strikes Back. There's all of these layers of revisionist history. Leia and Luke's their lineage, for example. Like, are they supposed to be siblings? Well, he's given multiple accounts on that. I'm willing to cut him some slack too. And here's why. It's fake and in space. This is a fictional universe. It's storytelling. It's mythological.
Space wizards.
Yeah, it's mythological. And as such, you know, oral storytelling, such as the many great myths that Star Wars is based off of, does shift a little bit from time to time. And you can have different versions of the same story that basically mean the same thing, but might have had a little different detail here and there. When we talk about truth from a religious perspective, it matters a lot more that we are accurate and that we can hold to some sort of foundational principle regarding what is truth and how do we navigate truth? How do we navigate differences in how we comprehend that truth and then pass along what we call truth? That's when it gets a lot more, the stakes are a lot higher for me personally. What about you guys?
Yeah, definitely. I was giving Scott time, but yeah, definitely so. Because as you said, while we're willing to kind of show some grace and you know, cut a guy some slack for a story that spun out to be probably wildly bigger than what he had originally or what he had once set out, it's still a fantasy. And Jared, I think you're right to draw analogies from the world of mythology, that a lot of the mythological accounts that we now know today as the Greek myths or the Norse myths or whatever, those started out in a variety of ways as well, and then, you know, eventually kind of coalesced around, you know, certain key points. With truth, though, in the sense of, you know, what it was that actually happened, what was actually said, it is much more necessary to land on, you know, land on things that did happen, things that were said. And I would say, though, without cutting out totally the possibility for some variation in interpretation, we do have four gospel accounts about Jesus's life in the New Testament.
Really nuances this whole conversation, doesn't it?
That tell essentially the same story and have many of the same beats, but do have various highlights and different emphases here and there, to where there are noticeable differences from time to time.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Actually what I was trying to. I was trying to get to that, figure out how to articulate what Kevin had just said about, you know, you have the four main books and then with the same beats, but there's different things between them. And it doesn't change the story, though. You know, it doesn't really affect the story as the entire thing.
Yeah, certainly. And so this is one of the really interesting points in all of this, is that we do have differences in perspective and we have different ways of coming at topics. And you don't have to listen to very many podcasts to hear that different hosts can approach the same issue from different angles and to look at it differently. Scott, Kevin, and I all have drastically different life experiences, though one huge thing in common. Two huge things in common as Star Wars fans and as Christians. That's kind of our whole thing. How'd I miss that? We have two huge things in common. Nevertheless, a lot of different backgrounds in terms of how we look at subjects and different approaches to life even. And so how can we then find common ground? All right. So first and foremost, let's deal with Obi-Wan's statement. Is Obi-Wan right, objectively right, or is he objectively wrong when he said that, yeah, Darth Vader was killed by Anakin? It depends on your point of view. I was right from a certain point of view. Was he right, or is he just the pathological liar? I go back and forth on this one.
It's tough because, especially, I think that I haven't read, now full disclosure, I haven't read any of the books of anything. My Star Wars life is the movies and now the TV shows. So I don't read the books and I don't see these other things. But, you know, and watching the Obi-Wan, seeing how he reacted to seeing Anakin, and that's how he was thinking of him at first. And then he saw them at the end as Vader. He doesn't see him as Anakin. So I think in his head, that's how he kind of reconciled the fact that you know, Vader killed Anakin, even though he was majorly responsible for it as well.
He
always fails to admit that part.
Yeah, I'd just like to see a little bit more humility from old Obi-Wan. But the revisionist history, you know, Alec Guinness is not the same. You don't have the same tremendous history with the character that we now have, especially with the new Disney Plus series. There's a lot more added to it, in my opinion, because of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the new series that we have. It really does help flesh out the Vader-Anakin dichotomy, how they do dwell in the same body, and yet there is this delineation and compartmentalization of the two identities. You know, weigh on this one, Kevin. Objectively, is he a liar?
Oh, goodness. It's tough for me to be objective because my favorite character in all of Star Wars, besides Bail Organa, of course, is Obi-Wan Kenobi. I think there's a condition that needs to be discussed first before we can say objectively, is Obi-Wan right? Maybe I'm finagling here, special pleading. In the world of Star Wars, perhaps it is just the way it is that one person can essentially have within them grow and take like another person can grow and overtake them, almost like some kind of psychological disorder or something like that, which we would have things analogous in our world too. And so if in the world of Star Wars, that's at least comparable to what we see, where one can genuinely say that this, you know, within this one body, essentially two persons existed, then yes, I would say that Obi-Wan, it's true. The reason why I think that there might be something to that is, especially if you have seen the animated Clone Wars series, because we get so much depth of adult Anakin that we actually get to see all the kindness and really like loyalty that Anakin Skywalker shows. And there are also very clear moments of darkness and of, you know, well, they should be made to agree, and that kind of thing, to allude to that line from Attack of the Clones. So yes, if all that's true, then if that can actually exist in the world of Star Wars, then yes, I think Obi-Wan, I think we can let him off the hook and say that my man speaks the truth, and he's right about that.
Yeah, I'll accept that. I'll accept that as an answer. I just feel like somehow I need to slip in Kuwiel in The Mandalorian, who says, "I have spoken," right? I mean, that's such an important part in all of this, that, well, whatever Obi-Wan says is truth, right? At first, that was the narrative. And yeah, you know, if you look at it from a different point of view, technically, Anakin Skywalker is still in there. But from a certain point of view, we'll let it slide. I've always been a little bit troubled by Obi-Wan twisting the truth. And Luke is as well. Luke is upset by it, and rightly so. I understand Obi-Wan's reasoning for keeping the truth from Luke and Yoda as well. They don't come out and tell him, "Oh, hey, by the way, here's the true story of your father and Darth Vader." I don't think Luke should have had to hear it from Vader. It's kind of a misstep. And so I think, you know, painting in broad strokes, the fact that Luke is able to learn the way that his own mentors and masters had taught him, and to say, I don't think I'm going to do it that way. You know, he disagrees with the teaching methods of his masters and says, I still appreciate you. And I don't know if love is on the table, but honor you, respect you. And yet, man, I'm really miffed by this. You really should have told me. Why didn't you tell me the truth? And they made the judgment call. Hey, you weren't going to be able to handle this until you were ready. Is there ever a time as a Christian to withhold the full truth from a person? Is it ever ethically passable to have to twist the facts or withhold key details for a person's good? This happened to me. This happened to me a number of years ago. A huge detail was left out concerning a big event related to me. Later, superiors revealed, there was a little bit more to that. We were trying to protect you. And I'm still to this day on the fence about whether or not they did the right thing. Is it ever acceptable? This was not in the notes. I'm springing this on you. Can you hear them sweat, everybody, listeners?
I'm waiting for Scott to wade in on this one.
So one thing I was thinking of, and maybe not telling the full truth, is maybe like some of the brutality that Jesus went through, like how vicious people were, and maybe tone that back a bit until someone is mature enough to understand that. I mean, still say he died on the cross, but maybe not all of the horrific things that he went through. You know, maybe holding that back a little bit might be until someone's mature enough to understand. I think if I have an inkling of what you're talking about, Jared, and I think that would be in the wrong to hold it back from you.
Okay. It would be in the wrong to hold
that's
back.
That's just my opinion.
Key facts. I think it's there's a difference between manipulating a person and wanting lovingly to protect them, therefore withholding some information. What I would do, at least what I think, like I've had to deal with some of this in hiring and firing recently, is sometimes you have to say, there's more to this story, and I wish I could tell you, but I'm not at liberty to do so. What I can tell you is so-and-so has your best interest at heart, and I really hope I get the freedom to be able to elaborate on this more fully later, but I'm beheld to certain obligations. And yeah, I think it's just best to be as open and transparent as possible, even if you have to be open and transparent about the fact that you don't know everything, right? Or that you can't reveal everything. When it comes from a biblical perspective, Jesus is quite clear with his followers that he's going to, for example, die and be buried and raised again. He gives them that nugget of truth, and yet they don't seem to know what to do with it. They argue with, Peter argues with Jesus about it a little bit, but besides that, they seem to not quite grasp what he's throwing down. Nevertheless, Jesus says, I don't even know all the facts concerning the second coming, for example. Not even I know the day nor the hour. There's examples there of the Father withholding key details from Jesus, and we're not going to try to wade into the right and wrong of all that. Nevertheless, to say having absolute information isn't, to Jesus, one of the requirements for being a faithful follower, right? What we do have is what God has revealed to us, right? God has revealed truth to a certain extent, and he's given us what we need for, what's the passage, Kevin, that life and godliness?
Oh, goodness.
I'll find it.
I know what you're talking about, and it's just, it has escaped me.
I'm so close to finding it. 2 Peter chapter 4, 1 through 4, his divine power has granted us everything we need for a godly life through our knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness. So he's given us everything we need. We might not know all of the answers, such as how do we deal with the problem of suffering, or the exact scientific game plan on the creation of the universe, but what we do know is what God has revealed, right? And some of those aspects of what we're discussing here for us as Christians are non-negotiable aspects that we consider truth. And truth that's revealed by God that's not open to subjective points of view, right? Let's talk about what some of these non-negotiables are. When we talk about absolute truth from a biblical perspective versus relative truth, what is our perspective on how we ascertain truth? And then how we navigate differences and how we comprehend that truth with others. I would say, first and foremost, we have to deal with the idea of revealed truth from on high. These are the passages, for example, in the Old Testament that we might call the thus saith the Lord's, right? These passages when, for example, a prophet says, I'm no longer making up a sermon. This is directly what God has given me to pass on to you. And I may not totally understand it, and we may not for thousands of years, but this is the message, and here it is. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, right? And so passed on from on high, direct divine revelation passed along through a prophet or some sort of mouthpiece, right? Not everything in the Bible falls into this category, though. And that's where we end up, having some differences of opinion or differences in interpretation, right? So how do we understand absolute truth versus relative truth as Christians?
I like the start. I like starting with Revelation.
Okay.
Little R, Revelation, not the last book.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I was looking for like the angel wings and the beasts. Yeah.
Although the book of Revelation is, you know, obviously totally full of little R revelations, things that were hidden and are now revealed. And those things are absolutely true, but those things are also given in ways that are very highly context specific. The fact that, you know, the fact that these monsters, your Bibles might call them beasts, but they're essentially monsters that show up in Revelation chapter 13 or so. The fact that they come out of the sea is an important historical detail. The fact that the number 666, that's a highly contextualized truth that still absolutely refers to a person, but is pretty highly contextualized. There is very much a basis in things that God has revealed to us through prophets, through his son is the sort of greatest example of what it is that God has revealed to us.
Yeah, truth incarnate.
Yes, very much so. And then, because I think as a way of presenting truth in a way that is understandable, God sends his son to operate like a rabbi, a profession that other people in Judah and Galilee would have known about. Hmm. And, you know, he's a craftsman. and he, you know, he teaches in ways that are understandable to, you know, the people around him. He talks about what the scriptures say, you know, like other teachers would have. He just so much of what Jesus did was intelligible. So even though it's, you know, the absolute truth of reality, you know, incarnate, it's made relative because it fits within a specific historical context. I really meandered through to get to that last point there, that you have this thing that is totally absolute. And it also, but it is also relative in the sense that it makes sense. It's intelligible in its day and age and part of the world. Does that make sense? Yeah, I had to find myself there for a second.
Let's keep chewing on it a little bit. So we've got general revelation. God reveals himself and certain eternal qualities about life and humanity, what's right and what's wrong. He reveals himself and always has to all peoples and all cultures. There are very few cultures that are in disagreement over certain key issues. We end up twisting things and we wander from our roots, but in general, we hold certain elements as right and wrong, that it's wrong to steal, that it's wrong to kill, pedophilia, bestiality. There are exceptions, but by and large, we learn this is not good, or this is the right way that our culture should operate. We do learn a couple different places in scripture that God does reveal himself in this way. God doesn't keep anybody in the dark on certain key qualities. Then we have what we call special revelation, that is that God has revealed more specifically what is right and what is wrong and what is required and who he is and what he's like. And these would include, right, these thus saith the Lord's God speaking through a prophet or revealing himself through his word. And then I'm wondering if we can even have like a more specific category. Maybe that's just the ultimate special revelation is Jesus, embodied revelation. What's amazing about the way Jesus embodies truth is that he's not always eye to eye with the religious teachers of his day. So there are really good, godly, faithful people who lived and walked on the earth during Jesus' lifetime, who had good intentions, who understood the law differently than he did. And Jesus finds himself in hot water over, I mean, it's pretty much every page of the Gospels, isn't it? Can you think of what some of these issues are? I'm talking a lot here. We've got like how do we handle the Sabbath day? What are some other ones?
Money.
Sure. Yeah. The company we keep, Jesus is in hot water about dining with sinners, purity rituals, hand washing, and this sort of thing. They have the same Bible, right? The same Old Testament, the same law. Jesus and the rabbis, the Pharisees, they interpret it differently. We can say, well, Jesus has the trump card, being, you know, the Son of God. But when Jesus says in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he's saying that truth is revealed most clearly, most specifically through me. Out of any point in human history, I have come and made it clear and knowable. And yet Jesus doesn't interpret the law the way that the majority of the religious elites of his day did, showing us that you can have the same text and not understand it the same way. Nevertheless, go ahead.
Honestly, I think some of it is also what people are using the text as an intent for. There are people out there who want to use it to maintain power.
Sure.
So they're gonna say, mm-hmm. Well, it might say this, but what it means is this. So you have sometimes people who are trying to use the words for their own benefit.
Yeah.
And maybe they believe it themselves. Maybe they don't. I can't speak for other people, but, you know, I think history is rife with that kind of things, especially when Jesus shows up and the leaders of the day are like, wait a second, this guy's undermining our whole power base. So, you know, we have to try and prove him wrong as much as we can. And he's hanging out with sinners. He shouldn't be there. He should be with the godly people. You know, people, you know, twisting some of that stuff. So I think intent has a lot to do with perspective as well. Oh,
it's a great comment, Scott. It's a great comment. Yeah, you can certainly argue during the ministry of Jesus and throughout human history that quote unquote truth can be called truth. And we say, I've got the right thing. And anybody who disagrees with me is a liar. We've seen this even very relatively recently in our own culture, where we draw lines in the sand and we say, well, we're looking at the same quote unquote facts, but we've got different facts. Who's right and who's wrong? How do we come back to a base then? How can we get beyond, well, it all just varies on your point of view? Why is it important that we as Christians can have a baseline of some non-negotiables that are revealed from on high? And then how do we verify them? How do we prove them? How do we test them? We're not just required to have blind faith. There's so many different ways to test the validity of what we're learning and of what God has given us. There was a point in time where I kind of felt like every issue was a salvation issue. Anything that I believed about Christianity, about religion, I had to have my opinion right in order to be saved. And that if I was wrong on one thing, then I might as well be wrong on everything. And that anybody who was wrong on one single point about how to be a Christian or how to live a godly life, that they were lost. And they had to be in a church that was right on everything, right interpretation, right practice. Not necessarily right attitude, but what mattered then, what mattered most was right, right interpretation and then right behavior in my perspective. And I heard this sermon that was every issue is a salvation issue. And I came away from it feeling a little icky by a really great person that I admired. And I kind of felt like, is that true? Is that right? And navigating these issues, what I came to see personally was what I believe is that there are core issues that Jesus reiterates over and over and over that are maintained across the Old Testament and the New, and that these are the non-negotiables of our faith. For example, 1 Corinthians 15, Paul navigating a really messy church situation where they had so many things wrong about what it looked like to be church and to practice Christian spirituality. Paul paints this picture of love, and he says, if I have the greatest spiritual gifts there ever were, but I don't have love, then I have nothing. That was scary to me to read that and to realize that love wasn't high on my priority list compared to right opinion. Mm-hmm. A couple of chapters later in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, this is the gospel that I passed on to you that's of first importance, that Jesus died, that he was buried according with the scriptures, right? There's a way to test this, to verify it. This was prophesied long ago. It came to pass that Jesus was raised from the dead and that we've got all these witnesses, and he lists off all of these people, this person, this person, this person, this person. Go ask them. They were there. They can give you these details that could not possibly be made up, especially when you start to confirm them one after another after another. This is the faith we pass on to you. Historically verifiable. This is the most important thing, that Jesus died, was buried, and was raised again. That then is the hook on which the rest of our faith hangs. The point I'm trying to make is this: there are non-negotiables that we hold as absolute truth, and that's got to be our baseline. Otherwise, we're just like the blind man and the elephant. Y'all know the blind man and the elephant? I'm about to tell you my favorite little parable here. We can come back to it. What do you guys think?
Let's hear
how do we deal with absolute
it's relevant. Tell us about the blind
Scott,
man.
Scott, how
elephant.
Many sermons in Massachusetts did I incorporate this little parable into?
I'm not sure.
ask your teenagers. I'm sure they could tell you every last word of it. Yeah. It's this. It's a poem from the 1800s by, is it John Godfrey Sachs? I believe. I don't have this in front of me. It possibly is an even older parable than that. The basic idea is there are the six men of Indostan, the blind men, all grasping an elephant, and they're touching different parts of the elephant, and they're drawing different conclusions about it. One touches the tail and concludes an elephant is like a rope. One touches the leg and says an elephant is like a tree trunk. One touches the ear and says an elephant is like a fan. And that parable is wielded in the darker underbelly of the internet, aka Reddit. It's wielded by the skeptical and the jaded to make the point that that's what religion is. We're all grasping at different parts of a whole, drawing different conclusions that seem valid to us. And yet at the end of the day, none of us can ever know the bigger picture. Why is that appealing in our current cultural moment?
Yeah, well, it definitely cuts down attempts at power grabs, which in a culture that is increasingly sensitive to power and how one wields it or who gets to wield it. If you can cut down power, attempts at, you know, plays for power by saying, well, none of you have the corner on truth. Mm-hmm. If you can just dismantle the notion of truth, then you've done yourself a favor.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So one way is to say, well, you don't really have the, who's to say that you're right? We're all just kind of making this up as we go along. It's pretty easy to see the whole, however, in this parable, right? And I want to make sure that we hold this with humility as we discuss this, to say, if you disagree with us about our religion, you're still welcome to listen to the podcast. We're grateful that you're in this space with us.
Yeah.
My intention of this is to not say you have to interpret this parable of the elephants and the blind men the same way as me. What I do want to say to those listeners, however, is that it seems of utmost importance that we've got to have some sort of external truth on non-negotiables that come from above, rather than just grasping around in the dark. If every human is grasping around in the dark, making it up as we go along, it's a really bleak world in which we live. Don't you think, Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, if we do find ourselves without any kind of measuring stick to say, like, okay, this is good and this is bad, and you know, this is a little bit more complex or something along those lines, you ultimately get to what is a totally unlivable situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my big hole that I'm poking in the parable. And I think in how a lot of people view religion today, is to say that we're not grasping around in the dark. We may not have all the answers, but we do have truth to the extent that God has revealed it. Not everything in life depends on our point of view. We can hold certain non-negotiable truths as having been externally revealed to us by the God above. And I would go so far as to say that if God hasn't revealed certain key truths to us, then he's cruel. I think I would ask yourself, if you say, well, there is no such thing as external truth, simply ask this: what if some truth has been revealed? What then does that revealer reveal about him or herself? What's the character of the individual who then has spoken? And that's what I love about Jesus, right? Let's get back to Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus doesn't just pass on truth from a cloud up on high. Jesus then embodies truth, embodies the character of God, not just the expectations of God, but the character of God, and he interacts with and loves and sacrifices everything for those who do not necessarily share his same outlook. Those who are skeptical, those who were actively hostile toward him, Jesus held absolute truth with absolute humility.
Yeah.
And we've got to be able to have some measure of both, right?
In a sermon one time, I told that parable of the elephant, and I ended it with this question, or I ended it with this statement: there's just one problem with this parable, with the point of the parable that many people draw from it, which is, you know, this kind of limited vision. The problem is, who has seen the elephant?
Sure.
We can all agree on what an elephant looks like. So my question for you is, who has seen the elephant? I went on with the sermon and then argued, Scott's coming
now back.
Scott's joining us again. He had little connectivity problems.
Yeah.
But my point was, Jesus has seen the elephant.
Sure.
And that's what Jesus has come to reveal. You know, if people were all, groping around in the darkness, finding hints of truth here and there, well, you can make some argument that that's what ancient myths were pointing to, this notion of that there are spiritual beings that do affect human interaction, and some of them are compassionate and kind, and there's also an afterlife and things along those lines. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, there's elements of that in mythology everywhere. But it's Jesus who has seen the elephant. And one way that we can know that what it is that Jesus has shown us is true is to take a critical look at our own experience. Now, experience can be not helpful at times, because I would venture to say that not everyone perfectly understands all their experiences all the time. I think that that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah,
but I think it is fair to at least ponder critically how and when our experience meshes with what it is that Jesus experienced and what it is that early Christians experienced. That I mentioned early Christians in particular to refer to the ones that we read about in the New Testament. And on those bases, we can begin to see a pretty high degree of continuity with the kinds of things that that we experience and they experience.
Yeah, we have all kinds of ways to verify truth, and we can do a whole apologetics episode, if need be, or if listeners have questions, we'd love to give. Well, here's the pillars and the bases for what I believe, and why I hold these things as non-negotiables, and to believe that there is some measure of absolute truth. We might have differences of interpretation. We're also then, this is what I love about the New Testament, we're also then given a template for how to navigate those differences in interpretation as we look to Jesus in humility, as we listen to his word on these things. Jesus doesn't just proclaim truth, but he lives it. And we follow him not just to be obedient to what he says to do, but in his behavior, in his humility, in his character. And we seek to be more like Jesus every day, as opposed to just trying to be right or have the right beliefs every day. I don't know if I've shared this before, but we won't get into all of our apologetics tonight. I will say a strong apologetic that I personally hold is that God didn't just give us truth from on high, but that he then took the weight of sin on his shoulders. We think about, well, certain things we might not have the perfect answer for, such as the problem of suffering. I don't have a perfect answer. I've got some somewhat adequate solutions in my thinking. But at the end of the day, what I come to is not an answer, but an act. I come to the cross. I say the one God who could possibly do anything about suffering took it on his shoulders and said, I'm going to suffer right alongside you, and I'm going to provide a way out. I'm going to provide an answer. And for me, the cross serves as such an important litmus test then of, is the God who has given us truth good? Is the God who's told us how to live and what to do, does he have our best interest at heart? Can we trust his word? Without the cross, well, it might be a different conversation, but with the cross, I think we can have at least some measure of agreement on how to live. Let's talk about this as we wrap up. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, scrambling there a bit, but I'm back.
Yeah, we're not just overpowering Scott here in the conversation. Episodes.
I was thinking about how do I slyly mention that that Scott's connection died, so people don't think that we just hosed him for 15 minutes.
Scott, it happens to the best of us and to the worst of us. I'll just say that much. Okay. Before we move on from the idea of can we ascertain some level of absolute truth, Scott will give you a chance to weigh in on it. How do we see Jesus intersecting with our notion of right and wrong, good and evil, truth and falsehood?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said it's kind of what we aspired for. You know, there's been many a times I've been living my life and doing things, and so a situation comes along and I'm like, I think one way, and then especially, you know, my wife being involved with a lot, being there saying, no, we shouldn't do this. And this is what we are supposed to be doing, going down the path. And it helps me reassess, okay, this is more the line I need to go down. And it's not about me, it's about other people. And I think that's kind of what a lot of what Jesus was trying to do is, I'm not gonna say it's not about him, but it's about how he treated other people and how he saw other people. He saw the value in everybody. And you kind of need to reassess sometimes, you know, your view on people.
And what's amazing about that, Scott, is even the people who don't believe that the thus saith the Lord's in the Bible actually come from God, most of them still agree that the character and actions of Jesus as revealed in the New Testament and the Gospels are admirable. I mean, most people who read the Gospels can say, well, that Jesus is a good guy. Whether or not he was the Son of God or actually rose from the dead, there are so many people who can look at Jesus and say, there's something there. There's something. And I would say that's a good starting place. If you're skeptical, start with the Gospels and say, but what if it's true? But what if, just for a second, Jesus is who he says he is? And do we have any way to verify that? So maybe that's to go deeper down the rabbit hole. As we wrap up, maybe this is tangential. Maybe it doesn't make the cut in the final episode. Obi-Wan has a point to a certain extent, doesn't he? Much of what you're dealing with in life depends greatly on your point of view. So Luke can take the point of view of rejecting his teachers and saying, you've withheld information from me, therefore I'm turning to the dark side because at least Vader was honest with me. But he doesn't. He doesn't, however, agree that his teachers were right in withholding that information. What he does is he goes and he holds on to this uncompromising belief that there is good in his father. And that changes the galaxy. How can we, on a practical level this week, maintain a positive, helpful, good Christian mindset in how we deal with people this week? What does it look like on a practical level to be able to have some sort of control over our point of view in how we navigate sin and temptation and evil and that neighbor who always seems to mow when you're trying to barbecue? How do we maintain a good Christian point of view in our outlook and in treating people this week?
I think a lot of what you're talking about with Luke, I think, is a great example for even people today. You see every issue has extremists on both sides and they're always yapping and trying to figure out how to convince you of something else. But if you maintain your own personal belief and not get swayed by other, you know, extraneous stuff or go along with a crowd one way or the other. He, you know, like you said, he didn't choose to stay with his father because his father told him the truth. He's like, okay, that's the truth. I know maybe I can't trust these people as much as I thought I could, but you know, there's still value in what they've taught me. You know, he still holds on to some of what they've taught him, even though, you know, they didn't tell him the truth right out of the gate. And I think that's kind of, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater at this point. If someone just does that, you have to assess what's mm-hmm. been said. And maybe that's my meandering way of getting to, you have to assess what's happening and deal with it sure. on an individual basis.
Oh, that's such a good perspective on how to engage with your local church too, Scott. Every local church, it has people who have made some mistakes. They might say some offensive mm-hmm. things. You might have some mistreatment, but you've got to be able to say, does that compromise my ability to worship God? Do I have to give up on these people, even if they're fallible, even if they've done me wrong? Is there a way to navigate these differences we might have with each other? Do we have something more important than can we agree on the temperature of the air conditioning in the building? or what decade the songs were written in that we're worshiping with this morning. There's so much I'd like to say about your comment there, but all right, move us along, Kevin. How else can we maintain a positive outlook from a Christian perspective this week?
Scott laid the groundwork pretty smoothly for what I was going to say. It is learning to give others, especially others who have over a period of time shown themselves to be your friend or to like generally be on your side, giving them the benefit of the doubt when they may say or do something that strikes you as maybe mildly offensive or stepping on your toes or something along those lines. Situation that happened some time ago. Apparently there was miscommunication between us and a friend, and in efforts to just tell them, hey, like here's some things that are going on. That was taken pretty harshly by this person. And resentment built up and then eventually came to a head, and I don't know that that's been resolved. A person in a position of authority where I work emailed some other people and just very, very calmly stated, hey, would you do A, B, and C to ensure that, you know, this space is ready for these visitors. And I had to assure that one of the other recipients of that communication knew that, you know, it was not intended to be harsh. It was just that this person operates in a world where clear, direct, and short, succinct communication is appreciated. But in a setting like ours, maybe starting with a warm greeting and saying, hey, hope y'all had a good weekend.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. When you get in the office, can you check A, B, and C? And
I'm a little bit of both. It just depends on the day and how much coffee I've had.
Yeah. But it's been learning to give the benefit of the doubt where if my initial reaction is, well, whoa, like darn, what happened here? Back up and then say, probably nothing to it. We'll move right along and we'll be okay. Cause I know, cause in face to face, this person is not a jerk. They don't wish me ill. I'm sure I'm not always clear or as warm and friendly as I'd like to think I am.
Yeah. I think that's an important point is, there's a difference between ill intent and misunderstandings. And sometimes all that's required of us is to take a breath and to ask a question. I advise people to all the time in ministry, people are upset with each other. And so they vent to me. And what I say is, you know, what I might say is this, hey, you know, when you said this, here's how it made me feel. Or I just want to ask, what did you mean when you said blah, 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 blah? Because I'm concerned of this, and just lay it out there. Be honest and be kind. Be honest and be kind. You know, is it really that hard? Hey, here's one last little piece of advice that might be helpful to you. Philippians chapter 4. Church in Philippi is being encouraged to agree in the Lord for all that we can debate exactly what that means. In this chapter that where Paul says so much about rejoicing and in good and in bad situations, rejoice always in every circumstance. He goes on to say this in verse 8, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Use this as a criteria. Just try it out this week, listeners. Use it as a criteria. Is this thing that I'm watching or dealing with, is the way that I'm behaving, is it pure? Is it excellent? Is it praiseworthy? Is my attitude about this situation, is it meeting this criteria? Is my mindset matching this? Is it to one of rejoicing, or is it one of a different kind of response? And if so, let's go back to the cross, back to the example of Jesus. Much of how your week is going to go this week does depend on your point of view. I think we can at least agree with Obi-Wan on that, right?
Yep, definitely.
Though I'm not sure that I want Alec Guinness or George Lucas as my preacher. What about you guys?
The tune tin seems to change quite a bit with George Lucas.
I hope he enjoys his $4.04 billion in peace and prosperity. And we'll continue to debate the universe that he has set up for us. What you got, Kevin?
He did donate half of that to different charities.
So. Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
That is, that's outstanding. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you rarely hear bad things about the guy. So. Absolutely. I had a point that I wanted to mention earlier, and I'm sorry to bring it up here at the end of all things, but I it was along the lines of the question you had asked earlier, Jared, about is it okay to, you know, maybe fudge the truth or leave out details or something along those lines? And I was reminded of how my children will often ask me questions that if I were to give an answer that would satisfy me, I would give them far too much information.
Yeah.
Occasionally there are questions that they ask about, you know, bad guys or things like that. I mean, because they're 6 and 3, okay? So they worry about bad guys and volcanoes.
And like, our new one is tornadoes.
Other dangerous things.
All of a sudden, our 4-year-old, where did she learn about tornadoes? Not from us. She's asking us all sorts of questions about tornadoes.
Yeah, but y'all live in Tornado Alley, so.
Not so much in Northwest Arkansas.
Is not in Northwest Arkansas.
Hills? The hills thwart the naders.
That's,
at least that's what I choose to believe.
If only that were the case in Middle Tennessee. But there are times when I sit there and think, I will give them an answer that for where these children are mentally and emotionally and spiritually, it is sufficient. It's satisfactory. It's accurate without being precise. And I think that's an important nuance for spiritual children. It is probably a good practice to learn to give accurate, if not always precise, answers. Because, well, you don't give actual children solid food.
Right.
You give them milk. It's a perfect example that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians. Going back to 1 Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about experiencing a vision, the likes of which he can't share all the details about, mostly because it wasn't for other people. It was just for Paul. Mm. And so there's also this notion that, you know, while truth can be revealed, it is sometimes not always wisest to tell all the truth at once. Mm-hmm. And maybe giving Obi-Wan the benefit of the doubt, as I mentioned just a minute ago, maybe that's what he was doing with Luke, who, as a force user, was very much a child, an infant in the force, as Obi-Wan begins to talk with him and share with him, you know, here's your father's lightsaber and you must become a Jedi like your father and stuff like that.
I looked to Jesus in John chapter 1, verse 14, who came and revealed the glory of the Father, full of truth and grace. And so I don't just want to be known as a person who has the truth, tells it like it is, but a person who can tell the truth with grace. Or a person who's all grace and only ever, it's just, you know, good vibes and whatever that means. But a person who has something worthwhile to say, makes an impact, and is passing along the, as a messenger, the words of God, make an eternal difference. So, yeah, I think, Kevin, sometimes on those, we've got to make judgment calls and have wisdom and discernment and humility. And so I hope that we can hold, if you hold exclusive truths that no one can come to the Father except through Jesus, personally, I want to be the kind of person who holds those truths with humility. And I think that's the example that we see in Jesus. Any last words, Scott? Kevin took us back to a topic from 30 minutes ago. Would you like to do the same?
Well, no, it actually did spark a little defense of Obi-Wan that everybody seems to hold Anakin and Vader as separates. Luke says, "I'm a Jedi like my father." When he says that, he doesn't mean like Vader. He means like Anakin.
Sure.
And so I think that's where where Obi-Wan was coming from, and separating the two personalities, if you will. So that's kind of my defense of Obi-Wan for all of this.
For all of his warts, we do love him, and he's imperfect, and that's part of what makes the character so endearing, yes. Right?
You know,
he's
aren't we all?
That's right.
It might be an interesting topic to tackle next time. That is it legitimate to split the two personalities? Because is it tempting? Would that allow someone to be tempted to say, "Well, that wasn't me," when in reality, it very well could have been you who did those things.
We've got demon possession in the New Testament. We've got the idea that there's an old person and a new person. We put on the new self. The old person has passed away. Split identities on hyperspace theology.
That might be episode 17.
I could see it.
We'll drop that in the Facebook group.
That's right.
That can weigh in on it. Discussion would generate.
Or perhaps we'll get something better coming from Andor. Well, regardless, that does it for this week. Thanks for listening to Hyperspace Theology. Remember that we'd like to hear from you. You can jump in that Facebook group. You can email us at hyperspacetheology@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram @hyperspacetheology. We'll be back soon with another episode. God bless, and may the Force be with you.